So, we talked, I think we talked the last time when you had the most recent James Bond book out, and that wasn't too long ago. It was within the past year or so. So what have you been doing since I saw you last?
I've been writing another James Bond book. I have done this book, which is The Secret Generations, which takes us beyond Bond, thank heaven, which is the first of a trilogy. And it is a fictitious account of the history of the Secret Intelligence Service and the Security Services from 1909, and eventually, when all three books are done, it will take us to the present day. All are seen through the eyes of two families, a British family and an American family.
It's the first of this trilogy. That's a big book, too, isn't it? It's more than almost 300, it's almost 400 pages.
It was longer when I submitted it. They cut a lot out.
How does it feel taking a break from your Bond thrillers to do something completely original?
Well, I've been doing that anyway all the time.
Yeah.
I fitted in other things with a book called Flamingo, which has not been published here yet, but is going to be published here, which I did in between, I think, Bond 2 and 3. And then I've been working on and off on this for quite a long while. I've just finished Bond number 5, which is called Nobody Lives Forever, which you're getting in the spring. And I've just had accepted the synopsis for the next Bond, which I hope is going to be called Tomorrow Always Comes, which is not bad for a title. And I'm writing that beginning January, and then I segue straight into the second book in this trilogy, which is going to be called The Secret Houses, as opposed to The Secret Generations.
Boy, are you busy.
I never stop.
No, what do you work 7 days a week?
Yes, I don't take weekends off. I have in the last 2 years taken holidays. I started taking holidays again 2 years ago. And that's pretty disastrous, really. I pine for my study and my books and telling myself stories. I'm a child at heart, you see. I just like sitting telling myself stories.
Well, what kind of day do you normally have? When do you get up and start to work?
Let's not go into when I get up, because that's always a moot point. I'm always at my desk by 10, and I work from 10 until 1. I take an hour's lunch break, and I work from 2 till sometimes 7 or 8, and if things are going well, and there's nothing good on television, I will go back and I'll do a little bit more, and right at the end of the day, just to wind down, I go back again and fight the Battle of Normandy or the Battle of Britain or fly a simulator on a computer. And that's my day.
Well,
my day by John Gardner. Third grade.
It's a lot shorter than the book. But I come into work every day, and we have, over the course of a day or so, some 75 people coming in and out of this newsroom. Plus, I get to talk to interesting people like you every day. But you're different. You go and retire in your office and at your desk, and you're by yourself. It's a very solitary life. Does this bother you at all, not having this interaction with other people the way office people usually
do? I have plenty of interaction with other people. I've got at least one business meeting a week, which means I drive to London to see people. And I live with my family, and I see them. I sometimes don't talk to them very much when I'm working, but, which makes them mad. But no, and the telephone keeps ringing all the time, and sometimes I have to turn it off. But I'm never alone. This is a wonderful thing. I think I said this to you before, Don. It's the marvelous thing about being able to write fiction. I feel very privileged, because we do, in fact, just sit and tell ourselves stories. And maybe it sounds crazy, but when you're writing fiction, you are surrounded by people. Admittedly, they are people who only exist in your mind, but they're people you get to know very well. And you live a sort of different cerebral life with these people who don't exist.
Well, Gregory MacDonald, who writes, he's got a hero called Fletch in Flynn.
Right, Fletch, yeah.
You know, I don't know if you know that series.
I do.
In fact, I believe MacDonald is now...
I read books.
I don't know how you have time. But MacDonald, I believe now, is president of the American Mystery Writers Association.
He is indeed. I'm a member.
Uh-huh. And he and I were talking about the solitude of working alone, and it seems to be getting worse, not so much for writers necessarily, because they've always done that, but because of computers. People can go to their homes, for example, insurance clerks could be given a computer and they could work out of their homes and they could sit there and type out all sorts of insurance codes and this sort of thing, and they could do it all day long and not see another person. And there is some feeling that because of the computer age that there is a danger that people can become too isolated, and this might take a toll.
Oh, yeah, I think this is probably true. And let me say, first of all, I'm a computer freak. I'm an absolute computer freak. I have four computers in my room. The president of Putnam came to visit me, a couple of months ago, and he walked into my studio and he said, "Mission control," because there are about four VDUs and three printers and goodness knows what. And yes, I could stay there the whole time. You know, with cans of food on a stove, I could live there quite easily. But I don't do that. I think you've got to have control over your own life, and you have to choose your time. When we first had television, people said that is the end of society. You can't mix with people because everyone goes home and they sit down, they get a TV dinner, and they sit down and they go square-eyed watching that peculiar box in the room. But it hasn't worked out that way. People now stop watching television. I mean, I record things that I want during the week, and then maybe one night I will sit down and watch them. Occasionally there are programs I watch regularly. Yes, I go out to parties. Yes, I do see other people, because it is a danger. But one thing I'd like to say, I don't like this business of... A lot of authors I hear talk and they say, "Oh God, it is terrible. Why did I choose this? Why was this thrust upon me? It is so lonely." How in heaven's name can it be lonely if you're an author of fiction? You know, you sit with, as I said to you before, you sit with people that you're creating. It cannot be lonely. Well, I have music playing all the time, too, because I'm a great music buff.
It's also, it seems to me, like a puzzle where you take your characters and you make them interact in such a way. It's almost like playing a game of chess, isn't it?
It's like playing a game of chess, and sometimes the characters take over, of course. That's the amusing thing. When a character takes over and does something that you didn't expect them to do.
Well, you must
in this book, The Secret Generations, for instance, the guy who turns out, I'm not going to talk much about it because I give it away, and I hope a lot of people are going to buy it, and I hope they're going to read it. But there's a guy in it who turns out to be a baddie at the end of the book, and I didn't know that until I got halfway through the book. I realized what he was and what he was doing, because when I work on a very large book of fiction like this, and this is not the first thing I've written of that length, I like to find out about the people. Sometimes they take a wrong road, and I just have to scrap it and junk it and start again from a certain point, because I know it's getting nowhere. But sometimes they take over and take a right road.
Well, certainly The Secret Generations is one of your more ambitious efforts, and you must have done quite a bit of research. With these four computers that you have, do you have a modem, and did you use that to help you gather information for the book?
No, I have a modem, but I don't use it for gathering information. I actually read information from books, or go out and have lunch with someone, or dinner with someone, or make a phone call. No, I do not access public libraries and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I probably will in a few years when we get a little bit more advanced. I use computers mainly for sort of database files on characters. I write my letters on one particular computer because I've got a laser printer in it.
Laser printer?
I've got a laser printer.
Ooh. Is it, what is it? It's not an Apple, is it?
Yes, it is. It's a
$6,000 Apple?
It's a $6,000 laser printer and attached to my Apple Macintosh.
Oh, I've got a Macintosh.
You have? Isn't it a lovely machine?
Oh, it's a wonderful machine.
It's beautiful.
I've
just been out buying masses of software because I can buy cheaper over here than I can in England, and I'm going to go back with stuff that you can't get in England yet. Which
it just keeps coming out. Every week something new comes out.
They're going to be hard drives very soon for it, and we'll be able to work faster.
Well, the hard Apple hard drive is supposed to come out in December.
That's right. We're getting it in January.
Well, it probably won't be out and available until about January, and it should cost $1,500.
That's right, $1,500 over here. Would you believe £1,500 in England? They're making the dollar equal the pound there. And I have one on order. But no, I use an Apple IIe to actually work on with a daisy wheel printer, because that gives publishers are old-fashioned people. They like to see a sort of typewritten manuscript, and the big daisy wheel printer that Apple does the job beautifully. And I just use the Apple Writer word processing program, and I work on that the whole time. I have a compatible 2C, which my wife does the corrections on for me.
I'm doing a little newsletter, and I use something, software called McPublisher.
And it's a better one than that.
It's wonderful. It if you want to do a newsletter, it gives you banner headlines, box.
I have a thing already set, Go.
Yeah, that's the expensive one, I think.
Is it?
No, PageMaker is the expensive
one. PageMaker is the expensive one, and all the reviews went for MacPublisher and PageMaker, and they said Ready, Set, Go is not very good. Ready, Set, Go is now in its second version, and the second version does everything you want it to.
MacPublisher is in its second version. I had the software for only about 3 weeks. I laid out my newsletter. It was beautiful. It's just absolutely gorgeous. I'll show it to you before I leave. Before you leave, and then just last week I got a letter in the mail saying they have upgraded it, so I ordered a second one now.
Yeah, well, I've just got my Ready, Set, Go upgrade, and I ran off just for fun. I played like you did when you were a kid with a printing outfit. You know, I made up a newspaper, which I sent to a friend of mine to make them laugh. And I did a sort of four-page thing with all ridiculous things.
Printed it out on your laser printer?
Printed out in the laser printer with illustrations and everything, yeah. It's great fun.
Oh, it is, yeah. You're in your second childhood, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I fly airplanes as well.
Are you a flyer?
No, I mean, on the computer they fly airplanes. Oh. I have flown, yes, but... not for a long time, but I use that nice Sublogic flight simulator. I use that on an old Atari, and it's beautiful. It really is.
You don't have an Apricot, do you?
No.
Supposed to be a very good printer.
I've got a 2E, I've got a Macintosh, I've got a 2C, and I've got an Atari XL, which is purely for playing strategic war games, and I fly the flight simulator.
What more does a man need?
Indeed, what more does a man need? And I have a large collection of recordings. And
What do you favor? What kind of music do you like?
Classical avant-garde music, really. People you may never have heard of, like Gerhardt and Penderecki. But no, I go for other people as well. I've just become very strange. For years, I could not stand opera, and it's in the last 6 years I've become an opera buff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm now learning about opera. Because music is a voyage of discovery, as you well know. And, I discover composers that I have neglected. This is a terrible admission. I have neglected Mozart until the last 2 years. And I've rediscovered Mozart now. I knew him as a child, but I've rediscovered him. And so now while I'm writing books, it's usually Mozart who's there in the background.
Well, let's talk a couple of minutes about the Secret Generations, because that's particularly why you're here. You have your family, the Railtons, but what I would like to know is how true to life is the actual history? I mean, how much of it is fiction and how much of it is real in terms of the creation of the British Secret Service?
There is a skeleton guideline in a sort of substrata of the book, which is real. For instance, the people who are in charge of the two main departments that I mentioned, which was MO5, which later became MI5, and is MI5 today. The first Director General of that was Vernon Kell, who is a character in the book. He was real. The SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service, otherwise known as MI6, which was known as MI1C or something in those days. Sir Mansfield Cumming, whose real name is Smith, in fact, and he changed it to Smith Cumming. And then when he was knighted, he just dropped the Smith altogether and called himself Mansfield Cumming. He was real, and the stories about him in the book are real. He did lose a leg in a car accident and actually hacked it off with a knife to try and get to his son, who'd been driving the car. That's real. Winston Churchill is real, of course. Steinhauer, who's in the book, was a German spy. He wrote a book with a modest little title after the First World War called I Was the Kaiser's Master Spy. Walter Nicolai, the head of the German military intelligence during World War I, he was for real. And the actual structure and formation and the way it was built up from about 1909 to the end of the First World War, that is accurate. All the other characters are fictitious. The Railton family is completely fictitious. But I have tried to interweave some real things that happened.
Well, with your background in writing spy stories, this must have been a cinch.
Well, not a cinch, no, it's not a cinch. It's fun. It was going out on a limb, actually. I mean, what I've been trying to do, what I am trying to do with the whole trilogy, is combine the novel of espionage with that great old favorite, The Family Saga. And if you can pull it off, well, it's great. I hope I pulled it off.
A generational novel about spies.
Yeah, well, three books of it, you know, and it's going to go on with two families, in fact. The American family, the Farthings, who appear very briefly in this. You know, one Farthing does, in fact, marry a Railton in this book, and you're going to see more about the Farthings and more about America. The battles in World War One are true, of course, and the strange explosions of ships in England, in dockyards, that's all true. Mainly the historical background is correct. Now, see, I'll tell you what I have done. One of the great things about doing a huge trilogy like this is one can take facts of which is an official version, and you can say, well, I wonder if that really happened that way. I have got a theory about it, and you can write it with your theory instead of the official version. The only illustration I can give you, that's a simple one in this one. I came across a letter from Clementine Churchill to Winston Churchill, written from Cromer in Norfolk, where she was with the children in 1914. And Winston, of course, was at the Admiralty, and she wrote and said that she had heard a very strong rumour that there was a plot to kidnap her by air and take her to Germany and hold her there for ransom against a capital ship, the Royal Navy. And this letter exists today, in which she says to Winston, if this should happen, you are not to give them the smallest or the cheapest ship. I could not bear to return to England as a ransomed woman. I would rather die and allow you to live a stoic. Now, I don't suppose for a moment there was really a plot to do this, but this letter exists, and it was too good. I had to invent a plot, and I invented a plot, and it's in the book, in order to introduce a major character in this particular book. And that's how you can play with history, and it's fun.
Well, boy, The Secret of Generations, it's a very timely novel, with all the attention on a family of spies here in the United States.
Yes, well, that's rather sinister.
You lucked out on that.
The Walkers, who raise a terrible situation at the moment, because they did it for money. I mean, up to now, we're used to moles, spies, who do it for ideological reasons. As I understand it, the Walkers did it for money, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in England, we've had the same thing. We've had a man called Geoffrey Prime, who was with Government Communications Headquarters, GCHQ, who undoubtedly did a great deal of damage and has done a great deal of damage. He, incidentally, was also a child molester, but he was doing it for money. And he's being put away. The thing that we can't understand in Britain, it's very difficult for us to understand your legal system. We don't have such a thing as plea bargaining. And I think there's quite a lot of feeling that that all these guys should have gone away for a long time. You know?
Well, Arthur Walker still got life in prison.
He still got life in prison. I haven't caught up on it.
Yeah, he was sentenced to $250,000 fine, got life in prison. The plea bargain was to have a lesser sentence for his son, I believe.
That's right, yeah. Well, you know, our people would probably say, well, no, this isn't right.
Well, it may not be right. The reason they do it is that if it has to go to court, then there's a jury, and there are all sorts of problems there. As long as justice is reached somehow in an expedient way without having to go to court.
Without having to go to court and without having to give away too much of exactly what has occurred.
Yeah.
What about Yurchenko? Can you understand that one? Because I don't.
Well, it's...
There are many scenarios that one can put together.
Nobody believes him. I mean, nobody believes
well,
that he
no,
was kidnapped and drugged and all of that stuff.
I mean, no. There are great parallels with the case in the late 50s of Dr. Otto Jahn. Do you remember that case? Dr. Otto Young was head of West German intelligence, and he suddenly disappeared from the West to the East. And about 3 months later, he reappeared with the story that he had been drugged. I actually interviewed him. I got him on tape telling the story, and I can't tell you whether he convinced me or not, quite frankly, but his story was he had been to see a doctor that evening who he knew slightly, who wanted him to sign some papers. He went in, the doctor offered him a cup of coffee, and the next thing he knew was he woke up and he was in the East. Guys with guns behind the curtains when he made his television press interview. And he did it all under duress, which is a very similar story to...
In this country, it's very hard for a governmental agency to kidnap someone, bring that person back.
I find that very strange. But I also, I must say that I find it a very strange operational thing that they allowed him to hide in plain sight, that they actually allowed him out of a safe house into a public restaurant with only one guy.
It's a democracy.
I know it's
that's
a democracy.
What they kept saying. You can't keep them chained up. It's not like Russia.
I realize it's a democracy, but operational technique on the debriefing of a defector is usually very tight and very close, and you do keep them confined because they do get nervous and they do walk away if you keep them out. I just don't understand the operational techniques of if it's all for real, how he walked away. I mean, Gordievsky hadn't walked away. And he's sitting somewhere in a safe house being debriefed, which will probably take about 2 years.
Now, it'll be interesting to see what they do to him.
We never knew what happened to Penkovsky, if you remember.
Yeah.
He just didn't, you know, Penkovsky was a man who was providing information to a British courier called Greville Wynne, who got caught, and they were both tried. And Penkovsky was sentenced to death. Wynne has himself admitted that he doesn't think Penkovsky was actually executed, and there's very strong evidence he's still alive. And it was Penkovsky, of course, who handed over all the information about the Cuban Missile to the British Secret Intelligence Service, who handed it on to the CIA, who handed it on to President Kennedy.
Douglas Turman wrote a book recently. I can't remember the title, but he wrote a thriller within this past year in which he theorizes that the Cuban missiles were never removed from Cuba and, in fact, are still there pointed at the United States.
Yeah, that could be true, and it doesn't make any difference because it is known that they were very, very old missiles. They were very outdated, and I have heard the theory expressed that they really were no missiles of any importance on the convoy that was heading towards Cuba, and I have heard it said, whether it's true or not, it was all a great setup for which the Russians actually won in the end, because they got President Kennedy to sign a piece of paper saying that never again would American soil be used to launch any kind of attack upon Cuba.
Well, they can do that from submarines.
Well, yeah, sure. Sure.
Well,
it's all very interesting.
Spying, secrets, boy, it's a wonderful
thing. Which is what's fun with doing a book like The Secret Generation.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I can't wait to finish the next Bond and get back into that family and move to the next phase, which is World War II. And the third phase will be the Cold War.
You live in Oxfordshire.
Yes, right.
Is that near Oxford? Where is that exactly?
Oh, yes. Oxford is the main city in Oxfordshire. And I live about 15 miles out of Oxford, in a tiny village called Bloxham, mm-hmm. Bloxham. And it's pretty good.
It's been several years since I've been up there. I did drive up to Oxford once to see the countryside. And one thing on the road up there, I didn't take the highway, but took the back roads, and I noticed those thatched cottages along the side of the road.
Yeah, Cotswold stone.
Oh, they were lovely.
Lovely sort of honey-colored stone. And I have a house there which is made of Cotswold stone.
Not thatched, I hope.
Far from being thatched, no. A thatched roof would be a bit much on mine. Mine was built in 1745, and it does have a slate roof. It has to. It's three stories.
Seems to me those thatched roofs could cause fire problems, couldn't they?
They have got around that now.
How do they do that?
They treat them with chemicals.
They treat them, yeah.
But I tell you, the art of thatching is dying out. There are very few people who can do it. And they're in great demand around that area, I can tell you.
Well, they better make a go of it while they're still there.
Well, they better train somebody else as well. You can't thatch by computer.
No.
There's no microchip available for thatching.
Well, John Gardner, it's always a pleasure seeing you and talking to you. You're certainly an interesting guy, and you have a very big following in the United States, as you know. And so I know that your fans are going to look forward to reading The Secret Generations and also the two books that will follow that, not to mention all the others you're coming out with. Well, do you have a bibliographer somewhere who is keeping track?
I have, actually. Yes, Mr. Otto Penzer is keeping, the Mysterious Bookshop is keeping track of everything. In paperback, you've got another book coming out, I don't know when, next year, called Golgotha, which is a book that was missed here at some point, and Berkeley are going to do that at some point next year. But at the moment, it's The Secret Generation we want people to buy and to read, and I'm not worried about that in particular. I want them to enjoy it.
Well, one thing is sure, John Gardner is not going to get writer's cramp.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.